This is Driven by Data, the podcast.
Welcome back to another season of Driven by Data, the podcast. Powered by Orbition Group and hosted by me, Kyle Winterbottom. We are delighted to bring you season four of Driven by Data, the podcast, and our aim remains exactly the same: to bring you some of the most respected and recognized thought leadership figures from the world of data analytics to share their knowledge, ideas, use cases, and insights across how they've tackled some of the industry's most trending topics and challenges. All that's left to say is sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. Welcome to Driven by Data, the podcast, season four. Have a slightly different episode for you today. So I'm going to be joined by Ranil Betheju, who is the Chief Data and Analytics Officer for Lloyds Banking Group. This interview was from the face-to-face session that Ranil and I did at the back end of 2023, which ultimately became the featured leader article in the Driven by Data magazine. And given that the next edition of the Driven by Data magazine is going to be out in a couple of months' time, we thought it'd be worth airing the episode over the podcast. Enjoy.
Ranil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
I know you're a busy man, so we'll try to get through this, but may I be the first to congratulate you on being the first featured guest of the Driven by Data magazine?
Very honored, Kyle. So, I think we had a podcaster about a year and a bit ago, so really honored to be back and be your first featured person.
Our content team scrolled over many profiles looking for the right type of leader. Obviously there's a lot of people doing amazing things in the industry, ultimately landed on you for all of the various things that you're doing here at Lloyds Banking Group. So looking forward to kind of delving into some of that to let the audience know exactly what those amazing things are. I guess before we delve into that, though, do you want to give everyone a brief intro into your background, I guess, journey up until this point?
Sure. So look, I'm currently the Chief Data and Analytics Officer at Lloyds Banking Group. So I think most people know Lloyds is one of the UK's cornerstone companies. And so I've got the privilege of leading the data and machine learning strategy and implementation at Lloyds. Love it. It's a great role. It's all grounded by our purpose, helping Britain prosper. But I've been working in the data space for about 25 years. So I actually started out back then we were called data miners. So my first gig out of uni, got onto a graduate program, and I'd done engineering at university and basically was trained up to do data mining at ING in Australia. Loved it. And I didn't realize at the time that it was going to take off, but I loved the work and just really fortunate that over that 25 years, data has grown, you know, all the new technologies, whether it's AI, cloud, machine learning, that basically had a 10x growth. And I basically sort of ridden that wave. So I started in Australia, worked there for about 10 years, and then did a stint in Asia. So I worked at Singapore and Hong Kong, and then moved to London about 9 years ago. So definitely feel that data and analytics has helped me travel the world and my kids and family as well.
Nice. So you mentioned offline very briefly about the size of the operation here. Just give us a very brief kind of snapshot of just how big it is and the job you're actually doing.
Sure. So I look after two teams. So the first team is called the Chief Data and Analytics Office. That's got a number of specialist teams, like centers of excellence. So there's a data science center of excellence, behavioral science. We have a visualization sort of center of excellence, big focus on things like data management and data quality. And we've also got a data culture team. So that team's about 400 people. I also oversight a platform team. It's about 1,700 people that has a whole bunch of data engineers and product owners in that. So that's the team that actually builds a lot of the cloud platforms and new machine learning platforms that we're trying to use to really generate value for our customers.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess keen to delve into the journey that you're on, right? Before we do that, I always like to try and frame the conversation by trying to get an idea of what it is to be in your shoes. Like, why are you here at Lloyds Banking Group? What are you tasked with achieving? Like, what's the mission, as it were?
Yeah, so I always start with what's my why? Like, why am I at Lloyds? And basically, it's kind of, it's a few things, right? So firstly, I do feel quite energized about the bank's purpose. So I'm kind of at the stage of my career where a role needs to have a purpose. And with Lloyds, it's helping Britain prosper. So that kind of really resonates with me. A, because I think it's an amazing purpose, but more importantly, with the skills that I have and the teams that I look after, you know, whether it's machine learning, AI, conversational banking, all of these capabilities can supercharge that purpose. So I feel that there's a really good kind of link there. So that's kind of, you know, kind of why number one. Secondly, Lloyds does have, one of the UK's largest data assets, right? So we've got 26 million customers, a massive breadth, whether it's, you know, Lloyds Bank, whether it's Halifax, whether it's Bank of Scotland, Scottish Widows, MBNA, we've got a really, profound reach into the country. So there's a really good opportunity to drive great outcomes. And then, you know, lastly, it's an organization that's going through a massive transformation. So we've had a new CEO for a couple of years now, Charlie Nunn. He's, you know, created a very, very sort of transformational growth-focused leadership team. And so it's infectious. So those are the three things that sort of, brought me to Lloyds and keep me here. But in terms of like what is it that I'm trying to do? It's really trying to transform this business with data and machine learning.
Yeah.
I'd like to help Britain prosper with data and machine learning.
Yeah, 100%. I think obviously you came on our podcast 15 months or so ago, give or take. And I think the reason why we'd reached out at that point in time was that I saw the kind of, you know, interesting things that you were doing. So I know that you were one of the first businesses out there that were kind of rolling up different types of skill sets, which obviously from our business perspective is really interesting to see, right? Given all the debate that goes on around the different skill sets that are needed to create a truly, you know, innovative and transformational data analytics team. And obviously we saw things like data ethics and data culture and comms all being rolled in to kind of supercharge that effort, which was really interesting. Value. I want to talk to you about value. So I think value has almost become a buzzword, right, in of itself in the industry, because everyone's striving for it. What does it mean? Different contexts, different organizations, etc. It means different things to different people. What does value mean to you within the context of Lloyds Banking Group?
So I'd probably start answering that question by saying it's the meaning has changed over the last 10 years. Yep. So if you rewind back 10 years ago, Ranil of 10 years ago would say, you've got to link value. It's got to be a number. It's got to be a revenue number or a profit number. And back then, what I would do is in the organizations I'd work for, I'd create an industry of people who would measure literally every aspect of analytics and try and assign a monetary value to literally every single thing that we did. And so number one, it was incredibly intensive effort. It was successful, right? So in one of the firms I worked at, we had this kind of number that was close to, it was $1 billion in terms of the revenue that the team would generate, right? And this was a scale global team across the world. And so I felt very proud of that number, as did my team. And we used it to really justify a lot of investment. So whether it was in cloud or whether it was in personalization capabilities, the fact that we could measure and show, here's our baseline, there was a lot of believability. That was 10 years ago. And I think things have really changed since then. So where we got to 10 years ago, so by kind of 8 years ago, people started to not believe the number anymore, right? So I think people sort of started to wise up to say, actually, you've got this number, but really analytics isn't the only driver, right? So effectively, if you've got analytical models driving a whole bunch of new next best activities, a lot of the outcomes are also driven by better content, human beings actually having the conversations, better customer journeys. So to try and allocate all of that to just analytics doesn't make sense, right? So, and then the debates around how do you apportion stuff became incredibly complicated. So personally, we've moved on. I feel we've moved on, right? So I no longer want to have a single number for value of data and analytics. Number one, because it's an industry of work. And I don't think it's needed anymore. So in most organizations now, there's a much clearer understanding of the benefit of, you know, analytics. So where we are now is rather than having a single number, we actually look at value in many different ways, right? So if it's for a marketing campaign, we'll look at test versus control, you know, what did you achieve, right? If it's for basically conversational banking, we'll look at things like how satisfied were customers in those interactions? Did they end up dropping out and going to a human? Or if it's in the context of automation, you know, how much back office work have we automated? You know, pricing models, how many additional loans have we sold? So we now look at much more specific metrics depending on the activity rather than try to aggregate this under a single number. So I think that's mature. So I personally, I would have loved to have stuck with a big number, but the feedback I got often from, you know, the CFO and the CEO was, look, Ranil, you know, your number, we've moved on. We don't need it. And it's also the amount of effort to create that just doesn't make sense anymore. And let's be a bit more refined about how we think about that.
That's really interesting, because I think you get a lot of debate in the industry, right, about it all needs to drive back to the top or bottom line, or it needs to be a number, a profit number, whatever the case may be. So you're saying that it kind of, it's more segmented, more specific to
the use case, right? And so you can use that to firstly understand how effective is the specific analytical workload that you've got. You can also use it to basically build a business case, right? So I think it's the maturity of many businesses, they get that now, right? Rather than this kind of notion of what's the big number, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess how did you get to this point then? You know, how do you get to the point of understanding what constitutes value across those different use cases? Like, is there a method to the madness, so to speak?
Yeah, so I really feel quite strongly that, again, over the 25 years I've been in data analytics, it's evolved. So when I started, it was a new thing, right? So I was a data miner. I was one of a very small team. We're centralized and working in an ivory tower and doing stuff, you know, off our own. And it was often quite difficult to impact actual customer and colleague or business outcomes, right? We were sort of in an ivory tower. Fast forward 25 years, again, you'll see models where most of the work actually gets done. It's embedded in the business, and it's almost impossible to see who's an analytics person, who's a business person. It's, you know, people are working much more cross-functionally. Often there will be centers of excellence in the center, but most of the work happens in the business. As a result, teams are much more closer to, well, what is it that we're trying to do? What are the specific, you know, colleague or customer or business outcomes we're trying to impact? Let's create the right metrics. So I think the whole notion of trying to federate out, you know, kind of analytics and data, I think that is where we are now, right? It's now become a much more mainstream capability. So the need to have all of it in a center doesn't make sense. So it's now federated out. And I think I shared this with you in my last call, right? So in 5 years, I don't think we'll even have the analytics people will be, you know, almost invisible within teams, right? It'll be a much more pervasive skill. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. I'll take note for that for my business.
So I think what you'll need, Kyle, is everyone will need to have a much higher degree of analytical skill. Yeah. There'll always be high-end specialists, but I think having thousands of data and analytics, I think that, you know, the trend is, you know, a lot more of it will be self-serve and people will need to up their data literacy and understanding of how these things work.
100%, yeah. Do you kind of proportion that as a pillar of the success that you've had here at Lloyds by kind of using that more fragmented within the business, getting closer to the business, et cetera?
Yeah, so for me, the goal is to basically continuously, you know, build up competencies, right? So new specialisms, and then embed them in the business team. So it's not one and done, right? So for example, at the moment, generative AI is the hot topic. And, you know, I've got like some people in the central team who have got PhDs and very specialized in this. But that's right now, this is new. Over the next few years, what we'd want to do is to start to embed more and more people with those skills in business teams such that in a few years, it's now mainstream. And then we can focus the central teams on what's the next big thing that we need to incubate. So I think that process of, you know, maturing out a skill and then embedding it is definitely where we want to go. And we see examples at Lloyds, right? So we, in the past, NLP, right? Natural language processing was a very specialized skill. We had some specialists with PhDs in the center. What we're finding now is that some of our channel teams where they build conversational bots, they've now got those skills and it makes a lot of sense. So we'll always have the high-end specialists in the center, but there's now people with similar skills actually embedded in business teams where they're much closer to the action.
Yeah.
So that's an example.
Mm. Yeah, interesting.
Just a quick interruption from today's episode to let you know that the next edition of Driven by Data, the magazine, will be launching in June 2024. As you may have seen on social media, we've got a number of industry partners that are raising brand awareness through advertisements and or contributing articles. If you think that could possibly be of interest to you and your organization, then please contact a member of the Orbition team today for more information. Back to the show.
Have you kind of landed on, because again, a lot of debate in the industry around quantifying value, what does value mean?
Yeah.
It being very contextual. I guess from your experience and maybe where you are now at Lloyds, have you put your finger on anything as to why you think some organizations do struggle to kind of quantify, articulate, attribute the value that they create within an organization?
Yeah, I mean, I was in that place like 15, 20 years ago, right, where basically I was leading big analytics teams, but in the center. And so just wasn't close enough to the P&L. And basically, you know, you'd build a pricing model, or you'll build a whole bunch of next best activity models, and they'd then be used by the business teams. And you weren't really close enough to how they were being used, how they're being implemented. And so it's difficult to really understand the value. So I think that, you know, as teams have got closer to the business, it's become a lot easier is how I've sort of seen things mature. So that's the big shift, I think, is actually having these, capabilities much more embedded in, like, kind of, you know, where revenue and value is actually being delivered.
Yeah. So obviously you've been talking there about bringing the data analytics spectrum of skills into the business. You mentioned literacy, you mentioned culture. What do you believe to be a data culture? Like, what is a data culture? And I guess, is that a journey that you've been on in trying, something you've created here at Lloyds?
So it's a journey I've been on. So again, like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, like even 15 years ago, right? A big chunk of my role was, and most data analytics leaders, was selling in the value of analytics and data. Here's why we need to, here's the case for that, right? So that was, there was almost a requirement to prove why analytics was better than no analytics, and why a, you know, a predictive model would be better than a sort of a, let's just contact everyone that we can, yeah, sort of type approach in marketing, or whether, you know, like a price elasticity model was better than some old rules that no one had changed for years, right? So that was a while ago. I feel I've been quite fortunate over the last, I would say, 10 years to work in organizations where that battle has, you know, has been won, right? And there's been sufficient senior leaders, like at the C-suite, who have basically grown up with analytics such that they get it, right? So these days, having to build a case about why you need to use analytics, it's not something that we do at Lloyds, right? So we don't need to. There's a much more stronger top-down belief that analytics and data and all these capabilities, they are sources of competitive advantage, and we need to invest in them. And it's almost now a really strongly held view that people have felt has been proven many times again. So the need to continuously reinforce that, I think, is less so in, particularly in banking, where, you know, we've had these capabilities now for about 25 years.
Yeah. Does that come from a top-down approach of having a senior leadership and CEO that understands the value and gets it, that makes it easier to embed that culture into typical business user teams?
So I'd like to say that actually you can drive data culture bottoms up, and you can create culture teams and have people like me try and, you know, the reality though is the biggest driver of a data culture in an organization is your CEO. And if I look at our organization, our CEO, Charlie Nunn, is a absolute passionate believer in the power of data, machine learning, analytics, Gen AI, all of these technologies he passionately believes in. And if I look across the world at organizations that are, you know, kind of always featured as analytical competitors, the key differentiator is the CEO absolutely believes in it and pushes it top down. That is the single biggest driver. And so if you're watching this and you're in data and analytics, pick a company where the CEO is an absolute evangelist for this, and then your career will just go gangbusters.
What's the symptom of that in terms of how does a let's say you've got someone at your level thinking about joining a company, and this is something that I get asked all the time, right? Because I think I'm a big believer and kind of pushes back onto individuals often, saying it's equally your job to interview the company to make sure you're going to walk into an environment where you can add value, where you can execute properly. What are the symptoms of being able to see if a CEO truly buys into
it? So review their statements, right? So go back over a 12-month period and have a look and see what have they said about data analytics, machine learning, data quality, data gut. Like what have they actually said about that? Are these things that they talk about a lot? Do they say in their annual report or when they announce their profits that they believe that data analytics is a source of advantage that they're investing in it? So I think you can really look at CEO statements, and you know, there's, you know, look at ours, right? So Charlie talks about hyper-personalization, talks about, you know, the value of really investing in our data, given the, you know, the massive footprint that we have. But equally, other organizations, many of the CEOs of those companies, they do actually personally talk about their belief in this. So that's definitely something I'd really recommend, is do your homework and, you know, just go over a 12-month period and have a look.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was another symptom as well, right? Sure. So the other one is investment, right? So it's all good and well to talk about it. Are you, as a CEO, backing that up with funding? And again, a really good question to ask is, how much investment are you putting behind, you know, analytics and data and platforms, right? So that's probably the second thing, is the quantum of investment. So there are companies where, you know, the CEO talks a good game, but when you look at the investment, there's nothing there. It's like, transform, but I'm not going to give you any money. So that's not going to work either. So there are always really difficult trade-offs about where you place your investment funding. If your CEO is truly an evangelist, they will actually, you'll be able to see evidence that they have, you know, put funding and put their money to sort of back this.
Yeah. So not only talk the talk, but walk the walk.
Fund it. Yeah. Fund it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. What's the relationship then between having an environment that has that data culture or allows that data culture to foster and mature in relation to realizing value?
Yeah. So part of it is, you know, again, it's got to permeate the whole organization, right? So you may have a CEO and a C-1 team that believe in it, but if it doesn't permeate through the whole organization, you won't get the value. So there is a lot of work for data culture programs to really upskill and educate, you know, people at a more, you know, kind of, you know, junior level across the organization about how they can use and pull these capabilities. So that is quite critical. So just having a CEO that thinks analytics and data is great isn't, and even backs it with funding, is not enough. You need that to permeate across the whole organization.
Yeah. Talk us through just high level what that culture team gets up to, because again, there's a lot of talk about that in the industry, not many businesses investing heavily in having a team that does that.
Yeah, so we kind of broke it up into two pieces. So the first is, I guess, data literacy, and within that there's basically two blocks. So one of them is, let's look at the skills and competences of the core data and analytics practitioners. So we want to ensure that there are very clear learning pathways for every single data and analytics job family. Let's map those out. Let's benchmark where people are and actually start a process of ensuring that we encourage. So at the moment, we're encouraging. There are other companies that incentivize this, but get people to understand that, you know, their career growth depends on demonstrating that they're learning new skills and also applying them. So that's the first part of it. The second is much more focused on the business community, right? So it's effectively saying, if we really want to move to this world where a lot more of the analytics and data is self-serve, where business leaders, P&L leaders are pulling data, they sort of do need to understand a lot more about it. So again, a set of programs about how do you upskill people, whether it's on what is a statistical model, what is machine learning, how do you need to think about ethics, you know, how do you need to think about data governance, how do you need to think about data quality. So again, it's a broader upskilling of the non-practitioners. But the goal is, or my goal is, you know, in 5 years, that group should start to be doing a lot more of their own work.
Mm. Personal question, what do you think of the term data literacy?
So look, it's one of those things where I don't know what a better word is. And so like a lot of these words are loaded, right? So even data culture, we have a data culture team. People always confuse it with the culture team, but it's not. Like, we have a separate team that does broader values and organizational culture stuff. So it does drive confusion. So we need to land on some better words for this. But to my mind, the literacy piece is more about upskilling everyone's knowledge, right? So that's one part of it. The part I didn't mention, Carl, was in addition to that, it's also about setting up the right communities across an organization. So, you know, I think I mentioned that, you know, the direction of travel now is for more and more teams to be federated out, to be embedded in the business. And so in the past, when you had a central team where everyone was all in one team, it's very easy to share knowledge, develop careers, share best practice, learn from each other. In a world where everything's federated, that's a lot harder. So part of the whole culture piece is trying to glue people together using communities and chapters, organized by job families, so that people can really share ideas, share use cases in a much more industrial sort of sense, but then also share those with the business colleagues as well, right? So often, you know, I think in the world of data and analytics, doesn't really tend to attract the most extroverted people. People do the most amazing work, but then keep it hidden. And so we're really encouraging people to talk about their work because it inspires other business teams and other analysts as well.
So as I mentioned earlier, Anil, I think one of the first things that I started to notice when you took the reins here at Lloyds was that there was these teams being spun up that were unusual, shall we say, in comparison to what we were seeing across other organizations in the industry. Ethics, culture, comms that we've mentioned. What was the catalyst for that? Like, what drove you to that decision that this is something we're going to need to really execute and get value out of this whole journey?
So with the data culture piece, right? So I've been doing data strategies for about 15 years, and they've always been pretty much the same, right? Across every organization, there's been, you know, a pillar focused on your data foundation. So getting your data organized and, you know, lineage, metadata, your data models, data, like that's foundational stuff. There's always been a pillar focused on, you know, maturing and creating like, you know, much better platforms and tools. And there's been a pillar focused on how you drive commercial outcomes, right? So that's been my standard data strategy. When I came into Lloyds, I had to think about that and kind of recognize that actually the missing piece was culture, right? So effectively done this, many organizations landed loads of kit, you know, but did it really get used as much as I would have liked? No, it didn't. And, you know, I realized that more effort was required to prepare the organization for the investments, for the capabilities of planning. So as part of that, I created with my how I thought about data strategy, a pillar focused on culture. And so that kind of led me to think, you know, I've got a whole pillar focused on this. I need more of a team to kind of help drive that. So that's kind of where the culture piece came in that it was something I felt quite critical. It's now part of my strategy. I sort of need a small structure to support that. So it's a small team, Carl. I mean, it's not a team of, you know, it's a very small team, but they are focused on, as I said, the literacy pieces and building those communities. So that was one. The other one was really around ethics, right? So what I'd seen over the last 10 years is that, you know, ethics, records management and privacy tended to be grouped together. And if you really think about those three things, they're very different, right? So, but also the types of people are different as well, right? So the world of privacy tends to, you know, people that lead those teams tend to come from a legal background, a privacy law background. And when GDPR became the big thing, lots of people gravitated to those roles. I felt quite strongly that actually I need someone to focus on how we embed ethics and controls all through the data science life cycle. Because I felt I need a different type of person. I need someone that's much more of a AI data science background who understands ethics so much so that they can actually build it into how we build models. So took the decision to write, going to build an AI ethics team. So this was more than a year ago. And then 6 months later, the whole ChatGPT thing blew up. And all of a sudden, you know, if you look at a lot of the all over the world, regulators are saying you need to have an AI ethics team that's focused on this stuff. So that was quite fortunate that I think got my timing right there.
Yeah. Talk to me a bit about that AI ethics piece then, in terms of just giving the audience a bit of insight into what that actually means, right? Because I guess, again, in the industry, you get a lot of talk around having a data ethics team or having a focus on data and AI ethics. But how do you go about implementing?
Sure.
What's the outcome, I guess?
Yeah. So our team, it isn't a team of ethicists, right? So these aren't people that sit in rooms and ponder ethical debates. They are much more of a team of practitioners. So few of them have like, AI PhDs, a few of them have data science backgrounds, but effectively what they're doing is looking at how we build models, how we do ML ops, and really working through what are the right level of controls we need to actually build into those, right? So that's kind of a core part of it is doing that. The other part is, particularly when new capabilities come up, really helping us understand what are some of the pitfalls, right? So with, for example, Gen AI, the whole piece around, IP and understanding where your data was sourced from, right? So helping us really think through that. And then thirdly, also, facilitating discussions around edge use cases, right? So one of the things that, is really important is we want to have a culture where people can experiment. Part of that, though, is rather than doing something that is going to be unethical, before you start, put together a very quick paper and let's have a debate. But the debate is really stacked with people with more of a customer background. But the ethics team really facilitates that. So that's kind of what they do. But it's much more of a team focused on embedding controls into a process rather than, kind of just debating stuff and writing papers. So much more practitioner focused.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm keen, before we finish today, and I know you're a very busy man, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I'm keen to obviously get into trends, the future, where you think the industry is going. It'd be remiss of me not to ask at this point kind of your involvement with Gen AI in terms of what you're doing at Lloyd's from a Gen AI perspective.
Yeah, so I'll be honest and say, Chet, when did that come out? It was in November of last year, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So for the first few months, I'm a bit of a wait and see type person. And then what I observed very quickly was, within a very small amount of time, basically I was seeing all over the world, all sorts of organizations with actually quite useful and very value accretive use cases, right? And if I compared that to all the other big tech fallstorms, right? So whether it's quantum computing, blockchain, distributed ledger, all of these things, like the metaverse, Web3, I didn't really see anything useful. So saw within a few months, wow, these are some really useful use cases, right? That I can see value. I started to see immediately overnight, all of the vendors building this into their core offering, right? And then also across the bank, various teams starting to actually use this to solve actual problems. So not because they wanted to be trendy and on trend. It was more, here's a way to solve a problem that I've been struggling with other methods. So as a result of that, we say, this is real. Let's create a sort of an environment where people are free to experiment, where they can actually start to experiment into these, but also in a way that we can then scale, right? So we're at the point now where we're doing various experiments, but we want to also be able to scale. And, obviously lots of conversations with vendors about how we can do that. One thing I would say, Kyle, is it is very new, right? So a lot of hype around what you can and can't do, particularly when it comes to scaling these capabilities. And that's where, I think a lot of the, the big players have actually, maybe oversold where we are, but there is a lot of genuine interest in terms of using this to solve problems that can't be solved with other techniques.
Mm, yeah. Where do you see the purpose of Gen AI kind of day to day? Because again, the scalability becomes a question, right? Obviously, there's pockets of use cases where it's obvious that there's value here, but I guess where do you see the use that becomes more valuable at an enterprise level?
Sure. So we kind of categorize the use cases into three. So the first is exposing Gen AI directly to customers, right? Mm. The second one is human in the loop. So effectively using it to almost be a co-pilot, right? Yep. So helping an RM summarize what they need to say to their client. And then the third is similar, but like kind of focus more on, tech problems. So for example, how do you understand metadata faster, or how do you develop code quickly, right? So three different categories. We're going to focus on the second and third, right? So the customer facing, use cases, I don't feel we're ready for that. What I do want to do though is have a human in the loop, or focus them on things where it's, less sensitive. So for example, things like knowledge management, where the hallucination risk is less of it. There's ways to control for that. So yep. It's a way to start. It's a way for us to really build up our knowledge whilst we put guardrails. And to be honest, I don't know whether we'll get to the customer facing one. So the thing about generative AI is it's not intelligent. And so the risk of, hallucination, I think it's, it's still kind of, you know, it's there. And depending on how people prompt, it's something that I'd want to make sure that we had all the guardrails in place, given we are a regulated industry, have a much bigger responsibility than, say, if we're in a retail business or, you know, restaurant or food or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes perfect sense. So I think, as we mentioned earlier, it was summer of 2022 when you appeared on the podcast, right? And you mentioned on the show that in 5 years' time, you didn't envisage that there would be a CDO role or a need for a CDAO role. Just remind us, first of all, why you said that. And now, obviously, we are about 3.5 years sure. away from that point in time. Where do you see us on that kind of journey?
So the reason I said that was, you know, it was this whole notion of federation. So CDAO roles, you know, so first there was the CDO role and then it became CDAO. And those roles are somewhat tuned to the time of big centers of excellence where you've got a big team in the center. And as I've said during this podcast, right, we're moving to a world where we want to federate out more and more to the business and effectively have loads of analytical people in business roles and, you know, and not even actually be an analytical team, like almost be a core skill. So that process is going to take probably another 5 years. So when you get to that point, the need for having a really big role coordinator is probably going to be less, right? So I think there'll always be a role for data governance, you know, all of the traditional CDO stuff, but the whole being the one person that orchestrates everything, that's going to diminish, right? That's what I'd like to see. That's what I'm hopeful of, right? So my work would be done when I'm not needed. So the other part is, I think CDOs all over the world are focused on building a whole bunch of enabling platforms like cloud platforms. But the goal is, once those are built, others can then use them in a controlled way with set patterns, right? So if we all do our jobs in 5 years' time, we won't need as many people in the center doing stuff. Like it should be well understood patterns where others can consume and build them themselves.
Yeah. I guess it's almost like the metaphor of, if you're doing your job properly, eventually you will do yourself out of the job, right? Because the need is no longer there because you've done it properly, as it were.
So I feel I've got a really good example of why this is correct, right? So rewind 5 years ago, every bank in the world had a really senior person as the chief digital officer, right? It was the chief digital officer and driving digital transformation. Look around now, right? So many of the banks have done those transformations. They don't actually have that role anymore. Or it's a much more junior role. It's not a role that reports to the CEO, right? It's still there, but it's, you know, become much smaller, less focused on a massive organization because everyone does digital now, right? So many organizations don't have a digital team anymore. Mm. So data has to go the same way, right? So when we spoke last time, I was talking about the chief electricity officer role from 100 years ago. Actually, we don't need to use that. We can talk about chief digital officers. Like they're less and less. Like they're, you know, they're not as prominent. Like I wouldn't be able to name any chief digital officers that become chief customer officers, or, you know, the roles are quite different now.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. So I guess to finish then, where do you see the industry heading, apart from obviously the elimination of the CDAO role? Where do you see us being in the next 5-10 years?
So I'm really excited about, the new breakthroughs with large language models, with foundational models, with generative AI. So I feel that has given so much excitement in this space, right? So as I said, I've been in this for 25 years and we've had loads of tech, kind of breakthroughs, but nothing has kind of galvanized the community as much as this. And, you know, the proof is it's embedding into everything. So I'd like to see these capabilities make all sorts of quality, whether in data or not, a lot easier, right? Work a lot more pleasant, right? Whether it's the various co-pilot capabilities some of the big tech vendors have, or just, you know, kind of data products that, people like, you know, my team would build, you know, really facilitating a much more smoother, frictionless work environment. So that's something I'm actually quite excited about. I'd love to really see that through.
Mm, yeah. Do you see a place where the whole debate around value becomes just kind of almost not even worthwhile debating anymore, right? Because I think we're still at a place where that's still a debate, because organizations are toiling with, how do we get value out of this, or how do we get more value out of this?
So There will be a debate about value, but on point discussion. So for example, organizations all over the world are moving their on-prem infrastructure to the cloud. Loads of benefit, but does it make sense to do that for every single on-premise data platform? No, it doesn't. Some of them, there's no real benefit, right? So when you look at things on a point view, you probably need to understand value. But I think as I said earlier, right? So I think a overall value piece, I think that's gonna diminish, but it will be a very useful lens to assess, you know, kind of point initiatives and you know, point work.
Unreal. Thank you very much for your time and congratulations again on being the first feature piece in the magazine.
Yeah, really, really appreciate you having me and really enjoyed it.
That's it for this episode of Driven by Data, the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week speaking with another thought leader from the world of data and analytics. Until then, please follow Orbition Group on social media if you've not already done so, where you'll be able to subscribe and therefore be made aware of the podcasts as they arrive. And please share, like, and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these two. If you've got any questions or you want to suggest ideas for topics or potential guests, then please feel free to reach out to me. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.